How many of you had your regular day this week, your regular schedule, start before 7 o'clock in the morning? Okay, a few of you. Any of you before 6 o'clock in the morning? Okay, a couple of those. Any before 5 o'clock in the morning? I'm not talking about you had to get up in the night to go to the bathroom. I'm not counting that one. But okay, so here's the thing is, before I went into full-time ministry, I was a mechanical contractor. I was in commercial HVAC, and I know what it's like to have, as my kids call it, a real job, right? I was a contractor in Denver, Colorado, pretty busy construction market, and I know what it was like to be at the shop before 6 a.m. to get the teams out to their particular job sites, and after they came in around 4:30 and wrapped up their day, I still had work, whether it was design work or estimating work, and so my days could go from 6 in the morning until 7 or even 8 o'clock at night. I lived on one side of town for one of my jobs and commuted to the other side of Denver, and it was, believe it or not, in Colorado, it snows on occasion, and so I'd have to navigate those streets uphill in the snow both ways, right? I worked for companies where I was overworked and I felt underpaid, places that didn't have benefits. There was a time that I was let go from a job, not because of a fault of my own, but because of an economic downturn. In other words, I know what it's like to have a real job Monday through Friday, or maybe even Monday through Saturday, and come Friday, the week is over, you're looking forward to Saturday, and if you were like me, Sunday was always given to church activities as we did Bible class, and Sunday morning and Sunday night, and usually some kind of other activity, and so you come in on Friday night, and you plop down in your favorite spot, and your wife comes in and says, "Hey, just a reminder, tonight's the marriage seminar," and you think, yay, right? I appreciate you being here, but more than that, I want to commend you, and I mean this seriously. Tammy and I have had the opportunity, as David said, to speak to lots of groups, and I'm not here to judge any individual because I don't have enough information, but I know that in virtually every place we go, there are individuals who go, "I don't need a marriage seminar. We don't have time for a marriage seminar," or there's something else more important. And I'm not saying that this particular activity is a make it or break it for marriages, but simply put, they're not giving much attention to their marriages. And if tonight you came kicking and screaming, being pulled by what little hair you have left on your head, I want to commend you. And the reason why is because you're being intentional regarding your marriage. I hope, as I expressed it to someone, that it's no worse than a dentist appointment that you're dreading. And when it's all done, you go, "Well, it wasn't that bad. I don't know what I was dreading." But hopefully along the way that you're going to glean something from it. But I can almost assure you of this. And I'm not just speaking highly of her because she's my wife. But I cannot tell you the value that women, that wives are finding in being able to hear from someone other than a preacher or a shepherd or a Bible class teacher about their marriages. They need to hear from someone who's truly walked in their shoes, another woman. And so tonight, your wives are being benefited by the time with Tammy. And if nothing else, I'll entertain you, hopefully, until they get back. All right, so that's the way we're going to approach it. I mentioned my dad being a gospel preacher for more than 50 years, and I remember when he would come in, he would always kick off his dress shoes that he had wore all day, and I remember when I was young, I would put my feet in his shoes, and I'd kind of shuffle around the floor. I was reminded of this a few years back when my grandson actually took the shoes off of my feet and put them on. He goes, "Look, I'm Grandpa." Right? Now, I knew that at that point in time, those shoes were too big for me to fill. They weren't my size. But it wasn't until I got married that I realized how big my father's shoes really were. Little backstory about Tammy and I that I didn't share in our introduction, not to reserve it for this, but when Tammy and I first met, she had very little interest in me at all. She didn't know it at the time, but Tammy was pregnant. And by the time we began dating, she had my oldest son, who is not my biological son. He was 3 months old. And we went out on our first date in the end of February, and we were married the end of June, a very short courtship. And I remember my mom telling me, she says, honey, she says, she said that because I was her favorite of the kids. She says, honey, we love Tammy and we love little Josh, but at 20, do you think you're ready for all this responsibility? And of course, Mr. 20 says what? How hard can it be, right? It wasn't until about 3 months into my marriage, and this is true, Josh, my oldest, was still asleep on a Saturday morning. Tammy was still asleep. And I sat straight up in bed, literally, with beads of sweat running off of my head. And all I could think was, what have I done? Just a few months ago, I was living with my folks. Now, don't confuse. I wasn't a millennial. I wasn't living in the basement. I was living on the second floor, okay? I was working for a large engineering company as a junior designer, and I was making pretty good money. I had a 1971 Plymouth Satellite, which to most of you won't mean much, but it was the sister car to the Duster. It had a 318 police interceptor in it, and when you punched it, it went, and I owned it free and clear. The money that I made didn't pay for rent, it didn't pay for lights, it didn't pay for this brand new technology called cable TV. It didn't pay for any of that. In fact, the only regular bill that I had at that time, ready for this? A full coverage on my car was $26 a month. That was it. And then, with a simple I do, my world changed. I became the husband and at that time a father as well. I was the leader, the spiritual leader, the provider, the protector, all those kind of things. And I went, whoa, these shoes are huge. And so before we try to get our feet into our wives' shoes, I thought it would be important for us to spend a little bit of time talking about not just the pair of shoes, but the closet full of shoes that God has given us as a husband. The first pair he slides out are a big, giant pair of black dress shoes, in which he said, you are to be the spiritual head of your family. I pick black dress shoes because when I was a boy, we had three kinds of clothes. We had play clothes, school clothes, church clothes. Don't let mama catch you playing in your school clothes, which was confusing because this year's play clothes often were last year's school clothes. But there was no mistaking that our church clothes were for church. For us, it was usually a little white shirt, maybe some black and blue slacks, and those iconic black dress shoes that my mom and dad on Saturday nights made us polish watching Hee Haw and Lawrence Welk. I mean, it was like a sweatshop, right? So we knew what those were. Don't get caught playing it. They were often pretty, but they were kind of uncomfortable. And so I think of spiritual things around those kinds of dress shoes. I'm not sure exactly why God chose to make you and I the spiritual head of the family, but I am convinced that He did. As the pages of Scripture open, Adam and Eve have been created. They've been put in the so-called Garden of Eden. They have a life without care, without worry, with God's constant provision, and only one particular warning, at least as we have it recorded, and that is that you may eat of every tree except for that one there. And like a hot plate at a Mexican food restaurant, when they say this plate is hot, what do? We touch it every time. And they went right for that tree, at least so it appears. And they ate of it, and it changed the world, and it most certainly changed their world as well. And so, in Genesis chapter 3, when the fall is recorded, we find that God turns to the wife and He said, your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. It is the exact same word that is used of a king that rules over a kingdom. Now, before you start thinking you're the lord of the manor, hold that thought before you come to that complete conclusion. We go on to find out that as Scripture unfolds, that this principle of male spiritual leadership is a constant through it. And we're not going to analyze all of those different occurrences in Scripture, but I think it's pretty clear. Now, whether or not it is, as Paul at least would seem to indicate, that man was created first, or perhaps it was that Eve was the first to eat of the forbidden tree, or it could even be, as one religious author put it, that we as men are not very inclined to do spiritual things. I mean, ladies have ladies' class and ladies' days and ladies' retreats. I did see one church up in Iowa that was, or Ohio, that was doing guys, guns, grub, and God Day. I mean, bless their heart, they were trying, but I don't know if it's the same thing. And so this author suggests that maybe God said, I need to assign you the task of being the spiritual leader, because if you're not given a task to do, you're just not going to do it. I don't know. But I'm convinced that that's the charge. But even more so, I'm convinced of this, and that is that I'm the worst choice, at least in our family. Tammy is more spiritual, frankly, than I am. Tammy is a better prayer warrior. She's a better Bible student. She is, if you had the opportunity, you'd find out that she's a better Bible teacher than I am. She would be the natural candidate to be the spiritual head of our family. In fact, I've got a full-time job just keeping me on task and on track in that department, much less being responsible for her and for my children. And so I think I can make the case with the Almighty and say, why me? Here's her. And he silently would slide those two big black shoes out in front of me and say, these are for you. So, as men is often the case, we will do what we know we can't do. If you don't believe that, watch that television's America's Funniest Home Videos, right? It always starts with something like, watch this, it'll be funny, you know? But we suck in our gut and we stick out our chest. We take in a big breath. We put our feet in those dress shoes and off we go. And God stops us, almost like one of those infomercial hosts, and says, but wait, there's more. And he slides out in front of us a pair of work boots. I don't know if you've ever had special kinds of work boots, but God says, not only are you going to be the spiritual head, the spiritual leader of your family, he says, you are going to be the provider for your family. Now, on Monday morning, if you're still working, not retired, and that alarm clock goes off, don't be mad at your boss. Don't be mad at the people that made the alarm clock. Don't be mad at your family because they got spoiled to eating every day. Be mad at Adam. It's his fault that you have to go to work. And although the sin of Adam did not pass from man to man to man, the consequences when sin entered our world did. And one of those was work. It is a consequence of man's fall. So we have Adam described as a gardener, one translation puts it, or an overseer. And we might think of the gardener of our day or a farmer of our day who tills the ground and plants the seed and waters it and fertilizes it, pulls the weed and stakes it appropriately and clears off the pests. But that really wasn't the way that it was. God took care of all of that. He was the one that planted and watered, and if we understand it, that everything was cared for, kind of this canopy, and it was a like a greenhouse. But Adam didn't really have to lift a finger to work until he fell, until he took of the tree that was forbidden. And in the same way he had brought a consequence upon the woman in childbirth and in regards to the male leadership or her submission, he looks to the man, he says, it's not going to be so easy anymore. From here on out, you're going to have to work, literally by your sweat. The ground will no longer readily release its crop, one translation puts it. He says you're going to have to work to make that happen. In fact, when we get to the New Testament, God is so adamant about this, and that it is more than just a physical requirement, but it has a spiritual implication, that when the Apostle Paul writes to the church in Thessalonica, in the book of 2 Thessalonians, he says, if a man doesn't work, don't let him eat. Now, he doesn't mean a man that's looking for a job and can't find it, or a man that's working really hard but isn't paid enough to cover all of his expenses. He's talking about the lazy man. He says, the lazy days were over. This is the time for man to work. In fact, when that same apostle writes to a young evangelist named Timothy, he I guess he reinforces, he underscores, he highlights it, he puts in bold, he circles it in red, and he puts it this way. A man who does not provide for his own, implied his own family, is worse than, one old translation says, an infidel. I like that a little bit because I'm not quite sure what infidel is. I'm an infidel, my mother dresses me funny, right? Until you begin to look at what that word means, and that word means is worse than an unbeliever. So the lazy man, not the man that can't find a job, but a man that is simply saying, I'm not going to look for work. I don't have to work. Now let me make one clarification so that there's no misunderstanding. I am not saying that it is wrong for a woman to work. I'm not saying that it's wrong for a woman to work and make more than her husband. I'm not even saying that it would be wrong in an arrangement where within that family, because of perhaps education or expertise or opportunity, that a wife goes to work and the husband takes on some responsibilities. What I'm saying is that like that little sign that's set on the desk of three American presidents, the buck stops here with you and I. That we have the responsibility to provide for our family. You can't tell it by looking at me, but I'm not always the best provider for my family. I have a tendency to be more the spender and less the saver. I'm the guy that thinks Amazon one click may be the best invention ever because I can 24 hours a day make purchases. Tammy's much more contented. She does not need stuff like that. She's not constantly looking for the latest, greatest gadget on late night television. And so, in fact, I remember when Tammy and I were first married, Tammy had just bought a brand new car, a Chevrolet Chevette. It's not fair to really call it a car, but it is, and it would be hers after 36 more months of payments. But because it was economical, I used it as the commuter car across Denver, and one morning or one afternoon, I came out to go to lunch, and somebody had stole the Chevette. Talk about desperate. So I called the police and I said, somebody stole my car. And he said, make and model. I said, Chevy Chevette. And he snickered. And I said, it's a car. And I gave him my name and the license number. He said, your car hasn't been stolen. I said, yeah, it's not that big a parking lot. He goes, that car's been repossessed. Apparently, monthly payment meant every month, right? We were at that phase of our marriage where we often robbed Peter to pay Paul, and occasionally we ran out of apostles. That's just how this was. Now, don't worry. We got the Chevette back. You decide if that was a blessing or a curse, but we got it back. But I realized I'm not always the best provider for my family. Tammy is much more diligent. I said, listen, she's more responsible with money than I am. Make her the provider. And by the way, I'm not just talking about financially. I'm talking about the provision for all of my wife and family's needs, right? God quietly just pushes those work boots out there, says these belong to you. So, in again with the gut, out with the chest, in goes the dress shoes, in go the work boot, out to work I go, and he says, but wait, there's more. And then he slides out this pair of combat boots, and he said, on top of that, you're to be the protector of your family. I know you're thinking right now, I'm trying to say this with all humility, you're looking at me and saying, Wayne, that's easy for you to say, being the physical specimen that you are. But it might go without your notice that I am not always the best protector. In fact, growing up with my kids, the general rule was family, wife, and kids, don't get me beat up. Now, today I could take any one of you out in the parking lot and take a whooping from you. I've had lots of practice, okay? But you wouldn't want to tangle with Tammy because, if you get between Tammy and her cubs, her babies, her kids, her grandkids, they won't even find your body. I'm just saying that, right? In fact, I hear somebody say, well, you got to remember, she's the weaker vessel, right? I mean, that's what Peter says. She's the weaker vessel. Now, let's see how I can say this. I don't want to offend anybody. Not all wives are fragile and frail. Does that make some sense there? But what it does mean is, like up in Denver, Colorado, where I grew up and raised my kids, They have a premier art museum there in Denver, and in one of the exhibit halls, they have this vase. They call it a vase. They put it on a pedestal. It's got a glass case over it. There's an alarm on that case. Big burly guy stands there and keeps an eye on it so nobody messes with it. Now, if you got past the guy, you got past the alarm and past the glass, and you tip that thing off onto the marble floor, do you know what happens to it? Guys, the questions get harder from here, so jump in if you know the answer. You know what happens when you knock it off? Yeah, it breaks. Why? Because it's ceramic. It's porcelain. It's fragile and frail. Now, where we just moved from in Oklahoma around February at what they affectionately refer to as the Walmart. At the Walmart, if you go, they have a shelf full of vases, okay? And if you were to knock one of those vases off of the shelf and it landed on the tile floor, do you know what happens? Don't say bounce. It doesn't. It breaks. It's fragile and frail. Peter is not saying that our wife is like a vase. He's saying your wife is like a vase. She's that thing to be elevated, to put on a pedestal, to be protected, to be prized. We got a lot of guys that are willing to take a bullet for their wife or at least shoot a bullet at somebody else. That they're going to protect their wives. You've gotten the nudge before, right? In the night. There's somebody in the house. There's somebody in the apartment. Tammy and I were living in what I affectionately refer to as the prison apartment, because it was a block building with what I was sure was inmates on either side. And she nudges me one night. Now, it said on the rental agreement it was a 3-bedroom, but one of the bedrooms had a toilet and a tub in it, so I'm not sure that it was. But it was so small, I could lay in bed and see the front door. Third floor, one night, Tammy nudges me, says, somebody's in the apartment. I said, honey, there's nobody in the apartment. I said, they have to get up the third floor to get in here. And she goes, no. I said, honey, the door's locked. In fact, I had one of those chain locks on it too. I said, I could see from right here. I said, honey, we don't have anything worth stealing. I mean, you know, finally in frustration, I went, if someone was in the apartment, they'd be in bed with us, right? That I had this fear of somebody going, I am. But they didn't, right? But I'm not going back to sleep until what? I got to get up and go check. So I reach underneath the bed for my courage, that flashlight with 12 batteries. And as I remembered, I started walking around the apartment, something like, I don't know who you are or how you got in here, but you'd be best served to go out the same way you came in. Thinking in my head, I shall hope there's not somebody in this apartment, because all I've got is an empty boast and a flashlight, right? Why me? Why call me when the vacuum cleaner is broken? Why call me when there's a flat tire to come change it? Why tell me the kids have stuck a Lincoln log in the toilet, or at least they think it's a Lincoln log? Why am I the one called to do that? Because I am called to be the protector. But here's what's so often tragic. The person who has the primary responsibility of being the protector of the wife is often her greatest adversary. The one who feels compelled to bring up amongst his friends all of her flaws. The one who seems to not let it go at Thanksgiving dinner when he has to describe how her gravy clots, unlike her mother's, whose thickens. Who has to berate her in front of the kids, berate her in public, and berate her in private when the husband, and I'm not even talking about those who go so far as to commit physical abuse against their wife, but simply are so abusive. The one who is charged with the protector is often the one who the wife needs protection from. We are to be the protector of our wives, and not just a willingness to take a bullet for our wife and to die for her, but the one who's willing to live for her. We'll reemphasize this, but the word love that is used specifically, for example, in Ephesians chapter 5, we often think it's about marriage. When it's more about the church, we just don't ever park on that very often. But it says regarding a husband loving his wife, it is a word that means a choice action, a sacrificial self-emptying of oneself for the sake of another. In other words, our responsibility is to not just be willing to die for our wife, but to live for her as well. Remember back when the husband would rule over his wife? Did you ever think about the role of a king in a kingdom? Oh, certainly he's the king and they're the subjects, and they might pay tax and they might pay their respects to him. But think about what the role of a king is of a kingdom. He sees that his kingdom is protected. He sees that his kingdom is provided for. And even though he stays the king, he really is a servant. I mean, we see that played out in our own government, even though it may not always work to perfection. But we talk about those individuals, right, who are appointed, who have been voted in as public servants, right? And so our job within our marriage as the one who is the provider and the protector is to be the one who is the servant of our wife, to outdo her in serving. And then there's one more pair. And I guess I could just say that, you know, we put our foot in that dress shoe and in those work boots, and we throw those combat boots over our shoulder like a continental soldier. And God says, but wait, there's more. And with the utmost respect due the divine, we say something like, now what? What more? Is this bottle for a water for me up here, David? Because I'm going to use it right now just so you don't feel bad about providing it for me. I took some allergy medicine, and it feels like I had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner cotton today. So anyway, but we do that, and I say, now what? And then God slides out what I think are the biggest pairs of shoe for us. In fact, it is so big, I can't give a shoe analogy for it. He says, you're to be the friend, the lover, and the companion. And that's huge, and here's why. When I tell you you're going to be the spiritual head or the leader of your family, that's a manly thing, right? I'm going to step up to the helm of the ship. Or if he says you're going to be the provider for your family, you know, you're going hunter, gatherer, right? That's manly. You're going to be the protector. That's all right. Step behind me, ma'am. I've got it from here, right? All those things are manly, but friend, lover, companion. Like I said, I've had guys that have suggested shoes. He goes, how about you make it the slippers? You know, when you get home, your wife gets you slippers. I went, you need to go to a seminar if you think that's the way that works. One guy said, how about flip-flops? Because like when you're on vacation, everything, I said, nobody wants to go to a seminar called his flip-flop, her flip-flop. Okay, that just doesn't sound very good. And then one guy came up to me and he goes, dance shoes. Because, you know, you're in step with one another. I said, did you just walk into a church building and come up to the preacher and suggest dance shoes? I think not, right? So we're going to leave it that way. But all of a sudden, we're frustrated that these shoes are so big that here's what happens. Guys beat themselves up. They can't make it work for them. It may not be noticeable because I'm wearing the size 7.5 shoe, but I have a size 6.5 foot. Parents wanted me to be a ballerina, and so long story. But anyway, I have these little teeny feet. And when I went into full-time preaching, I wanted a pair of dress shoes like my dad had. So I went over to the fancy shoe store. I didn't care. I mean, I wanted leather sole. I wanted to be really nice. I put my little petite foot up there, and this guy, thin Mustang, looked down his judgmental nose at me and said, sir, we have nothing smaller than an 8. To which I responded, fine, right? I got up, I left, I went over to the mall. Now, if you were in the shoe business, your grandpa or dad was in the shoe business, it's not about anybody in the shoe business. It's about this guy who last week worked at the corn dog place and now is selling shoes. He still got part of the lunch down his tie. And I put my foot up there and he goes, man, we ain't got nothing smaller than an 8. So I pick up my little foot and my dignity, and I go over to Jacques Penney. You ever been over to the J.C. Penney? Okay, I went back there, and there's a kid back there selling shoes, wants to be anywhere but there. So I put my foot up there, and I'm not exaggerating. I'm not telling a story. Here's what he said. Wow, I've never seen one that little before. And then he followed up with insult on top of injury. He goes, did you think about looking at our big boys department? And I said, I'll tell you what you're going to do, Sonny, a term of affection. I said, you're going to go back there and get me an 8 in that, and you're going to put on my feet and direct me to the hardware department. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm going to put that shoe on. I'm going to go over there and get me a ball peen hammer, and I'm going to beat my foot until it swells to fit in a size 8, because I'm leaving here with shoes. And that's what we do. We have big shoes to fill, and we beat ourselves up about it. We go to church and hope the preacher will beat us up about it, or the Bible school teacher will beat us up about it. Do you know there's even some churches in this very state that will bring someone all the way from California to come in and beat them up in hopes that they'll swell to fit, and we find out that we can't, and so here's what happens. I quit. I'm not going to do this anymore. And whether or not they stay in the relationship and stay with their, you know, their face in their hands, or they walk away from it because they can't feel it. And I can tell you that on that morning when I sat straight up in bed, I felt like the words that are attributed to Abraham Lincoln when faced with reuniting the Union. He said, I am inadequate for the task that lies before me. And I'm not sure that there's a day since then that I haven't felt that to some degree. The shoes we have to fill are enormous. I'll confess, when Tammy and I first started giving these seminars, I would come to a conclusion, I said, but we don't have a choice. We're going to have to do our best. We're going to have to pick up and clomp around in those big shoes. And then I had a friend of mine, he said, you know, you referenced Ephesians chapter 5. He says, you left out an important verse. That's verse 18. I said, verse 18? I said, that has nothing to do with the marriage thing. That's, do not be drunk with wine, for that's a dissipation. And he goes, yeah, go on. I said, well, be filled with the Spirit. He says, there it is. I said, what am I missing here? And he said, you're trying to fill the shoes by yourself, and you were never intended to do that. He said, first of all, God has given you a helper, one who is alongside of you and different but alike you to help you be who you're supposed to be. And when you try to do it yourself, do it alone without her help, you're going to find yourself deficient. And then on top of that, God has offered his providential care over you. I said, really? Okay. How's he going to help me be the spiritual leader of my family? And he said, well, how about he leads, you follow, and your family follows you, and you get credit for being the spiritual head. I said, okay, I guess that's a given. But I said, how about the mortgage? I've got to be the provider. And he goes, you understand that you can't save enough, insure enough, earn enough to provide for everything. God has access to everything, and when God runs out, he can speak to nothing and make something. So when he, through Jesus, says, seek first the kingdom of God, and the rest I'll take care of, he's not speaking an empty promise. He's there to provide for you. I said, okay, how about protector? How about the thump in the night? He goes, you know, man only has two enemies. Sin and death, and God's already whipped them both. In fact, did you know it's impossible for you to protect your family from death? Oh, you might delay it. You might get health insurance. You might get, I got a friend of mine, he's got, says, man, me and Smith and Wesson, I could probably shoot your foot off, anybody ever was in the house. But you may think all that, but you're only prolonging the inevitable. And God says, listen, if you continue to be who you're supposed to be and lead them the way you're supposed to lead them, they don't die, they just move to a different life. I said, all right, how about those unnamed shoes of friend, lover, and companion? He says, that's the easy one yet. He says, be like Jesus. Love like Jesus, who was willing to live and to die for his bride. He is the greatest lover the world has ever known. Begin to think about that a little bit, and I remember back when I would, by the way, if you tell this story to your wife, I promise I will sick Tammy on you and they will not find your body, okay? 6.5 size shoe comes with an appropriate body. My junior year of high school, I am 4'11". As I enter the school doors on that first day, you may not know this, but high school girls do not find any affection for 4'11". I mean, some of them will go, well, look how cute he is. But I'm just saying, they're not. I needed to be man height, and in my opinion, at least 5 foot was in the man heights. So I went home to where I built models, and I took a piece of balsa wood, and I carved 2 lifts for my shoes. Diane, don't be laughing at this, okay? And on that next day, I was 5'1" tall. Now, I could have been 7 foot, not felt any taller, but you know what I needed? I needed a lift. I needed something to make me more than I really was. And God says, I'm there to do that for you. You can't fill them by yourself. And here's why it matters so much. I am convinced that almost every wife is in love with someone other than her husband. She's in love with the man we pretended to be. You remember that guy who wrote her notes and called her sweet names and tried to impress her, told her mother how much you love that casserole, all those kinds. The one who finally proposed to her and she goes, yeah, I'll marry you. Or maybe it's the guy that we promised we'd be. You know, on that wedding day, we promised to love, honor, cherish, sickness and health, rich and poor, good times and bad times, keeping ourselves from all others just for her. And the preacher with some reservation said, do you take this man? She goes, did you just hear what he said, what he promised? Of course I will. Or maybe it is that she's in love with the man that she knows we have the potential to be. Tammy says that the first time she truly noticed me was the time that she had come to church on a Wednesday night. I was giving a great presentation as a devotional, which I affectionately refer to as beating Psalm 23 to death. That's what I call it. And she said on that night, she saw me and she leaned over to a friend who she had not yet told, because she hadn't told her family or her church yet that she knew she was pregnant. And she said, I could marry a guy like that. And so some 16 years into our marriage, when I finally told her, I said, I think that I want to leave the construction industry and I want to go into full-time preaching. She goes, I've just been waiting. She goes, I knew that I married a preacher, and when we got married, I just had to wait till you caught it up to figure it out as well. In other words, she's been waiting me out. Or maybe it is that she's in love with the man that we're called to be, the man she needs us to be, the man that probably down deep inside we want to be. And so it's really important that we let God help. I don't want you to leave tonight feeling overwhelmed by those big pairs of shoes, but instead saying, I don't have to do that by myself. I have been given a spouse, and I have a God who's ready to help me. And you will find it to be incredible. You will find a great relief, and you will find great success in being the man that God calls you to be. Ladies are going to join us here in just a minute, so I have time very quickly, unless they start walking in, and the story will have to wait for another time. Not that it's that inappropriate, it just makes me a little nervous, and here's what happened. A number of years ago, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. We have a pretty large seminar, about 200 in attendance. That was a Friday night and a Saturday, and on Saturday morning, the preacher, who's a good friend of mine, he says, I understand you gave all the men homework last night. I said, no homework, and he says, well, one of the wives told my wife that her husband came home and said as part of the assignment for the marriage seminar that they were to make love. And I went, whoa. I said, I would not have been as presumptuous as that. So on Saturday morning when the men were gathered together, just the men, I said, we got to talk about something. I said, apparently one of you is using this seminar for your own personal advantage and blaming it on me. So we went on through the seminar. It was all over. And afterwards, a guy walked up to me and he said, I'm the homework guy. And I didn't even catch it at first. He goes, I said, pardon me? And he goes, I'm the homework guy. And I said, oh. I said, well, I hope that worked out for you. He goes, it did. I wonder if I could get extra credit. Okay, so let me just tell you right now. There is no homework tonight, at least by way of assignment. And if one of you is thinking in your back of mind, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell my wife to come ask Wayne what our homework is. here's what I'm going to tell her. There's no better way to understand how valuable your wife is than by doing all the vacuum, the cooking, the cleaning, and the laundry for the next 6 months. Don't mess with me on this one. I'm just saying, I'm glad you're here. I hope you glean something from this. And beyond that, that's on you.